Okay, you're fine.
Okay. What I'd like to talk about, and as I indicated last night, both talk about a bit and solicit some feedback about and some thoughts from an experienced group about, is my interest in what's generally called religious experience, sometimes transformative experience. I generally use the term unitive experience, which is the more kind of non-theological heading for what I'm interested in. And I want to start by some reflections on Nick's presentation this morning, and basically on his thesis that we are, and correct me if I misstate this, Nick, that there's a sort of fundamental loneliness, as the Bossa Nova song goes, that's central to human existence for all our sociability. And so my remarks are sort of in the yes but category, because I think the assertion is essentially correct, but I also think that there's a long list of exceptions to that rule or to that generalization. And as I think more about it, I'm inclined to suggest that the human condition and the process of human evolution has to do with a kind of creative tension between the social drive and the fundamental loneliness, and that we do feel that. And yet, at the same time, there's a very powerful drive and need to express and to relate. And sometimes that expression can, as I suggested this morning, take the form of artistic expression, where the person has to bring out something that is more or less unique to his or her experience, which in powerful art becomes, in a sense, then universal property. And we find ourselves quoting poems and referring to paintings and so forth, because they seem to have brought out from somebody's loneliness something that reaches all of us, or certainly very many of us, and becomes a part of ourselves, part of our own way of comprehending the world, and that's very rich. I use the experiences of art, but that was only the first one that came to mind. I think that those kinds of things happen across a very wide spectrum of human experience and are a very large part of our cultural evolution, our scientific progress, among other things, where somebody comes out with something that is quite different from the way people had previously thought, and that then becomes, after the necessary period of time of everybody arguing with it and so forth, becomes a part of the wealth of human experience. And I think of examples like the one I'm sure you all know about, and the one in 1905, Albert Einstein was an obscure patent clerk in Bern, went to visit a friend of his, and they were both, I guess, wannabe physicists. And of course, in the evening, Einstein mentioned that he kind of had a hunch. It wasn't quite a theory, but he sort of had a feeling somehow in the back of his mind that the two fundamental truths about understanding physics at that time, which were Newton's laws and Maxwell's work on electricity and magnetism. And these were being held up by many people at the time as being almost the answer to everything. They were really the prevailing paradigm, if you will, or the paradigms. And the problem, and they could, as Lord Kelvin said, I think, about 1900, could probably, with just a bit more work, we can just kind of wrap it all up and we'll know everything about how the universe works, on the basis of those two. And Einstein said he thought that those two things just didn't fit together somehow. And he didn't, apparently, in the course of that conversation, he didn't exactly express what was the source of his feeling. And then, as the history goes, he was riding home on a streetcar that night, and he got to thinking about the clock tower in Bern. And that kind of got him to thinking about the idea that clocks, if they were traveling around the universe at different speeds, would measure time in an entirely different way, which was essentially the seed of the first paper on relativity, which, as you know, was one of four that he published in 1905, which is a pretty amazing piece of work. But was Einstein coming out of his loneliness, in a sense, in communicating that? Did he take any kind of a risk? Here was a guy, he probably wanted to get ahead and conform and all the rest of it, but he obviously felt a very strong need to put that idea out into the world. And although we remember it as being a time when he had great success as a result of it, there was also an enormous amount of negative feedback, meetings held specifically for the purpose of finding all the things that were wrong in this guy Einstein's ideas. I don't want to go on too far with that particular example, but I'm trying to suggest that that there's a lot of evidence throughout human experience of somebody coming out of their loneliness with something that becomes, in a sense, a gift to the species, and that it happens in many different ways, including politics, that a lot of the most creative moments in the advance of civilizations have come from people who seem to have, among other things, I'm thinking of people like Gandhi, among other things, a powerful need to communicate. And one of the things you may recall about Gandhi, which was that he would enter into dialogue with just about anybody. He wanted to converse with people. He didn't just want to argue with them. He talked to the judges who put him in prison, and he said to his followers, a group of his followers at one time, if I can remember it right, the point of political action is that the point is not to punish, the point is to change things. And so again, I think you'll find in a lot of political activity people who are being somewhat antisocial or certainly strongly combative, but also some people, a limited number of people, who seem to feel this need to communicate, to come out of themselves, to reach out to others. I'm certainly not saying it's universal, but I come back to Urban raised the point when Nick was talking that, okay, we have these examples of artistic creativity, but does that speak for everybody? That there's also the, you mentioned Jalaluddin Rumi, I believe, as somebody who didn't seem to be depressed and isolated and reaching out of his cave, but somebody who was very much in the whole world. But I think you can suggest that those kinds of experiences as well, that is the religious experiences that Rumi wrote about, are also fundamentally sociable, and part of examples of social intelligence, I'd say, rather than on the loneliness pole of our existence. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Elaine Pagel's book, The Gnostic Gospels, but there's a quotation in there from one of the apocryphal books attributed to Jesus that I've always found very powerful. And it says, if you can bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. So All of this, of course, is totally, as far as I know, unsupportable by objective science as part of what I, why I'm kind of particularly interested in the validity of exploring this within the context of subjective first-person kind of exploration. Because it happens to be a strong interest of mine personally. In other words, it's something I feel personally drawn to, and also feel drawn to in a sort of unconventional sense, in that although I've, as Jack knows, I've been explored within the spiritual traditions quite a bit, what I'm suggesting, and here I think is where I can safely say that I'm going to throw out a fairly outrageous proposition that I have no overall evidence for that you can, that we can debate, which is that the things we call religious experiences should be thought of not simply in a single category, but as a spectrum of human experiences that are probably universal. In other words, that my unprovable hunch is that everybody has experiences in the course of their life which have some of those characteristics, of which, to oversimplify them, are kind of what I don't exactly remember William James's words in Varieties of Religious Experience, but he said something that in his research, that although he found a great number of examples of very powerful experiences that seemed to be to have common features, he didn't think that they added up to any proof at all in the existence of God or the necessity of a belief in God. But if I can recall his words, he said something to the effect that what they do seem to indicate is that people are capable of finding a unity with something larger than themselves, and in that experience discover their greatest peace. And again, I may be doing some violence to his precise words because I didn't come prepared to put them up on a PowerPoint. I don't use PowerPoint anyway, but I'm sure all of you are familiar with James's work. I think it's very impressive. And the core proposition of it is that there is a human need there that's just as identifiable as a sexual need or anything else, that is common to us all, and that again is, I guess, in a sense, part of our loneliness. I'm looking at Nick as I say this, and also part of our essential social intelligence. It's something we may experience as loneliness, but also that people frequently come out of, and also that in these experiences, people discover a very real and very universal kind of sense of connection. I'm going to give a couple of examples and try to say a bit more about why I am exploring this. And this is, again, kind of coming from my own inner experience and my own personal agenda about this.
Well, can I ask something? Why do you say this is an outrageous hypothesis which got no objective support? It seems to be one of the most easily testable, and in fact, all the work has already been verified.
Okay, the part that I think is outrageous and not easily testable is that the experiences are universal. Everybody has.
I don't think there've been a lot of surveys, and you know, both the kind of the high kind, but also in the anthropologists and others. That is, you're right, it is universal.
My experience, well, here's part of why I'm doing this, is to get some feedback on this. The surveys that I've seen indicate that there may be, and the surveys that I've seen also vary all over the place in terms of the number of people who will say, yes, I've had a an experience that fits this description, but I've never seen anything that indicates more than, say, 50% of the respondents. Is that not right?
Yes, you're probably right, but if 50% are saying yes to a survey, I think that's actually pretty good evidence that it's much wider. And the studies of children by Jesse Baring and Paul Bloom and others finding in little children for these, Paul Bloom talks about natural born dualists, who are all attempts found out of them, as it is in some sense. Well, start the world, start their life believing in this larger realm of which they can enter.
Well, that's splendid. If that's the case, then half of my work is done. If it is recognized as a universal experience, which brings me actually to the second half of my agenda, which is why do we not act on the basis of these experiences if, in fact, we all have them or are in some sense aware of that realm of experience. My feeling about it is that even though this may be universally part of our, let's say, private lives, it's not part of what we might call the social vocabulary. It's not something we talk about a whole lot. As a matter of fact, I've occasionally brought together groups of people for the specific purpose of discussing things like this, and some people are willing to do so, and other people seem to find it almost more embarrassing than talking about their sex life or something. It's not something that people seem to feel terribly comfortable about bringing. I'd say particularly, in my experience at least, if you're in the academic world where they are not taken as being quite the thing to be talking about in public. You know. Let me mention a couple of specific cases that I find useful. One is the experience of a man that I've gotten to know well. He's a good friend of mine now. He wasn't when I first happened to hear a presentation of this particular experience. This is a man who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. He spent most of his life as an emergency room physician. And at some point when he was in his 60s, he was having some headaches and stuff. And after diagnosis, was informed that he had an inoperable brain cancer and had, I forget what he was given, 6 months a year or something of the sort, to live. And so here was a guy who had thought one day that he was a youngish man with a lot of life in front of him, and found out that he was not, and that his job was to get busy and make his plans and straighten out his affairs and get ready to die, which of course was a pretty strong experience, powerful experience. And then sometime later, after further tests and further medical work, and since he happened to be a doctor working in the Kaiser system, he had access to that, and he was told finally that wasn't it at all, that he had had a small stroke, and that he did not have a brain tumor at all, and wasn't going to die, at least not immediately. And that, he says, was almost as powerful an experience as the first one. I mean, he had just turned his life around once in the largest way imaginable, and then he had to turn it around again. I mention this background because I have found in my limited research in these that frequently the most powerful kinds of experiences that people have seem to connect to their engagement in one way or another with the big issues, mortality. In this case, sometime after he had gotten the second piece of news, he was out walking in the woods with his dog, and suddenly he had kind of got hit with, I guess, a period of temporary unconsciousness. He said he was, and he has a very odd vocabulary to describe this. He said that, that there was a period when I wasn't aware of anything except being in a place of what he called luminous non-being. And I've talked to him about this, and he will go no further in describing what he means by that, but that's where he was for a few minutes. And he said, so that during that the short space of time, he was totally out of contact, and then suddenly, as he says, it all came back. That is, all reality in the world came back. And he says, it came back like a clap of thunder. And he felt himself very tired. And he was about a 45-minute walk at this point from his home. And he got back with his dog trotting along behind him and took a nap, slept for about an hour. And he woke up feeling absolutely marvelous, better than he'd ever felt in his life. But as he describes it, it was with a clear feeling that he lived. This is kind of sounds a little illogical. I'll just try to give it in his words as much clearly as I can. He said, I knew, and I knew very clearly, he said, that I was living my life, and I was, you know, doing what I did and riding around in my car and all that kind of stuff. But that at the same time, my life was being lived by me, by what he called the all. He did not describe it as God or spirit or anything else. And I've known him for some years now, and every once in a while we talk about that, and that's just clearly absorbed into his view of the world as clearly as most people, you know, are aware of being individuals whose lives are not being lived by the all, as far as they know. And that's his worldview, that's his reality, and he's a thoroughly ordinary person otherwise. Now, I didn't know him before this happened, so this leads me to another one of the things that I do not at this point have firm proof of, which is, apart from that, or let's put it another way, what are the actual implications, the pragmatic results of that experience? Is he in some sense a deeper person, a better person? My experience is he's a really good guy. I know him very well. I would trust him implicitly. I was a bit skeptical about this particular experience when he described it. I am not anymore, because I find him to be a very honest person, one of the better people I know, and I know a lot of really nice people. The question I'm trying to raise here is, are these experiences, or can these experiences be, as so much of the religious and spiritual literature suggests, kind of opening a portal for further moral development? Do we become less destructive, more cooperative, more inclined to reach out to other people as a result of those experiences? If that's the case, if there is that kind of a connection, then it seems to me, and this brings me back to my kind of personal agenda about this, that further education about this, further learning about it, making these kinds of experiences more accessible to more people, it is very likely one of the most important things that we can do as a society, because to come back to my general perception of where we stand is that however common such moments of insight might be, they are not a part of what you might call the public vocabulary. They are in many societies, I believe, and have been in many societies, certainly are not in 21st century global society, and I submit that we could use them. I have also had myself and have reports on lots of people having experiences in one way or another are in the same kind of general ballpark as Steve's, but not as thunderously powerful as that was, but very common. I find personally that it's just kind of gotten to be part of the day's affairs that I have moments of feeling, of looking around and feeling that whatever I am in the midst of is sort of what the universe happens to be doing at the moment, and that I am not particularly present in that, although I'm aware of being present and conscious. It doesn't, you know, it's a bit paradoxical. But, you know, there's those that saying in the Zen tradition of things that you are seeing but nobody to see them, or heard but nobody there that hears. One day I was getting my driver's license renewed for the particular time that I felt this very strong. Getting my driver's license renewed, I was in the Department of Motor Vehicles in there in El Cerrito, California, and I had done the written test, and I was told I had to take a driver's test, and I was kind of pissed off about that, but I went out and got my car and waited my turn. And I had forgot to bring a newspaper, so I didn't have anything to do, and for some reason I didn't feel like turning on the radio, so I just sat in my car for 20, 25 minutes, kind of a quiet period, just kind of watching things come and go. And then I began to have very clearly that sense that what I was seeing and what I was in the midst of was a piece of something where everything that was happening was the one thing. It was kind of like a large organism or chunk of the universe that was kind of in the process of unfolding in very prosaic ways. And I was watching people walking toward this place and getting in line to go into the building, and I think a lot of them were had taken the bus to get there. They were getting their driver's license. A lot of them were obviously Mexicans. It's very important to get your driver's license. So I think there's a sense of empathy or compassion in it. But the overriding experience was just this sense of it's being one thing somehow, and of my consciousness as not being a terribly important part of it, and that it was, they also added to it was kind of the quality of the experience, was that it was very beautiful. Even though it was kind of a grungy place and a bunch of people doing something they would just as soon not be doing, but it seemed very beautiful, and I had a kind of general sense of love for the whole thing. And anyway, then after a little while, my turn came, and it turned out I didn't have to take a driver's test. And I got back to my sort of ordinary, ego-centered head and went home. But I find that those are quite common parts of the day, and that they seem to happen to a lot of people. And recently, I began experimenting with sort of a little game I play when I had nothing else to do with, which is just arbitrarily deciding whatever it is that's going on, just deciding to call it a religious experience and see how it feels. And I find that I did that this morning for a while. It's a very one thing I've noticed about it is that when I do it, the quality of the experience, of course, always changes, regardless of what it is. So try it. I'm sure most of you, as psychologists, are familiar with the work of that guy whose name I can't pronounce, Csikszentmihalyi, who's been doing the research on what he calls the flow experience. These seem to, again, come in a wide range of shapes and sizes. but they involve things that I'm sure never occurred to Henry James, William James, to record experiences about people having a sense of feeling to be at one with a boat or a ship when they're out on the water, that it's kind of all one thing that they're a part of. People feeling that experiences of mountain climbing and competitive sports and performing or listening to music. Wide range of experiences where people go into those kinds of spaces. And so what I'm interested in, kind of come back to my main point, at which point I'll just kind of take it on to solicit some feedback from all of you. What I'm interested in is how it, this kind of comes back to some of what you have on your agenda for the end of the conference, I think, you know, where do we go with this? How might we, if we want to, make this more a part of the public vocabulary than it is, in a way that would not be preachy about people's necessity to have this sort of kind of religion, because I think we've all had enough of that, but to somehow make it accessible as a wider part of the, what I call the public vocabulary, part of the skills of the human species, open and widely understood and shared. I think it would be useful to think of these as skills available, and that kind of knowledge can be acquired in part through first person exploration. That's my thought, and that's basically what I thought I would put into the agenda for today, and I'd like to get anybody's feedback about it for the remaining half hour or so. Yes.
What do you say about the relationship of mystical experiences to mortality? I think that's a key point. People have had these kind of experiences, like mountain climbers have had them when they've had a fall and they believe that they're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, I mean, they didn't actually die. And some near-death experiences also are, you know, have the characteristic of these mystical experiences. And it's an interesting fact that the two greatest Indian mystics of the 20th century, Raman Maharshi and Ramakrishna Paramhans, both had their, their spiritual God realization or, you know, their transformation through virtual near-death experiences. That is, in case of Raman Maharshi, he was like 16 years old, and he suddenly imagined that he was dead, and he really believed that he was dead. And from that time onward, he was a transformed person. And in case of Ramakrishna, he was a worshipper of the goddess Kali, and for 12 years he did intense spiritual effort. And, you know, he didn't get very far. And so one day he said, I'm going to kill myself because God has not shown herself to me. And so he took a sword and he was about to kill himself. And that is the moment he got his realization. So on the basis of this, what I think is that these experiences come when you deconstruct all the categories, everything that that makes you function in the world. I mean, the reason to analyze things into different entities is something that is part of our nature, and it's necessary to function in the world. The moment you get rid of everything, that is including your ego and, you know, the tendency to see things as separate, I mean, when you don't have any need to do that anymore, when you believe you're dead, then you go to a more basic form or more basic state of mind. So I think that what these experiences do is give you an insight into the fundamental architecture of the human mind, how our cognitive system, you know, the basement, if you will, of the structure of our cognitive architecture. And you know, one way at that, one metaphor that I have is that we have a telescope, and we look through it, and we see something, and we assume that it's something far away, maybe a galaxy that's millions of miles away. But what happens when all the constructions are destroyed is that it's like as though the lens of the telescope has inverted, and what you're now seeing is the structure of the telescope in itself. So, so that I mean, it's very clear that mystical experience is some kind of very fundamental and powerful experience, which is, and that's why it's universal, because it tells us something about the architecture of the human mind. And I think that that would be a very good place for cognitive science to go, to actually look at all these religious and mystical writings and figure out what, you know, this basis of the architecture of the mind. I mean, it's like the software of the brain, or, you know, that. And another thing that I wanted to say is that these experiences have been systematized by a philosopher named Walter Staes in 1960, in which he described 14 different characteristics of this experience. Some of those you've mentioned, like, you know, all is one, so it's a unitive experience. Another one is that it's the greatest or the most powerful experience that you can have. It's an experience of universal love, or, you know, it's a very positive experience, the most positive experience you can have. And there's an experience of eternity and infinity. So your sense of time is kind of, you know, you see eternity, and space again is fully, is expanded into infinity. And there's a paradoxical quality about the experience. Obviously, because, you know, normally we see things as separate, but now we're suddenly seeing them as one. So it's a very paradoxical experience. And there's no, you know, in the final state of the experience, you don't really, there's no cognitive content. You're not, you know, it's not like seeing an image or anything like that. It's like I think you used a term there. But in Buddhism, it's shunya, which is nothing.
Yeah, shunya. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but in spite of that, when you come out of the experience, you have a sense that you've gained a great insight.
Mm-hmm.
So actually this has been turned into a psychological scale that you can rate, you know, mystical experience. And there are certain drugs that reliably induce that. And recently, actually last year, there was an experiment at Johns Hopkins where people were given psilocybin. And so they were given either psilocybin or a placebo, or, you know, a drug that has similar, that's of similar nature, but doesn't give this experience. And then, you know, they were asked on the basis of this mystical questionnaire, and it was reliably, they were able to elicit that kind of, I mean, obviously what I described is a full-blown experience, which very few people have, maybe, you know, few people in history have had it, but you can get parts of it. You can get only eternity, or you can get only apology. And so in this study, they actually followed up these people for a year or so, and they asked their co-workers about their attitude, and they found that that these people had become kind of better people, you know, that they were more like. I mean, it is there, and it can be induced by, you know, some drugs. Is that the real experience? As far as the user is concerned, I mean, it's indistinguishable. So, I mean, where do we go from here? Do we want this to be something universal? The flip side of it also is that, you know, obviously this kind of experience would reduce motivation that we normally have, because that becomes the focus of your life then. I mean, you... So obviously, you know, evolution doesn't want us to have this experience, which is why it's so hard to get. And I don't know, nobody has done these, you know, nobody has actually seen whether people in their normal drives to achieve, you know, would those be dampened by having such an experience? I think it would, because now you're going to, you know, you go into something, you basically have the greatest experience that a human being can have. So all other motivations will pale in comparison. So it's an interesting social question whether, you know...
In my opinion, that's one of the unanswered questions. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions that, yeah, you're going to, you know, sit around and contemplate your navel or whatever for the rest of your life. But again, I certainly see some evidence, at least, that people are capable of just kind of walking around with this sort of worldview and functioning
I'm sure they function normally, and in fact they're better people, but
there's been very little empirical work on what changes it produces in terms of pro-social attitudes and so on. But I had a PhD student at the New School in New York who looked at the effect of attending raves with the ecstasy and the drugs associated with it, and found very positive outcomes. I mean, in terms of, well, she focused longitudinal study in people who became regular ravers, and well, you know, reputation of ravers as drop ups and people who aren't around in society. But she found, you know, major impacts in terms of.
Boy, that's news to me. I often thought that fairly awful experiences wouldn't.
So coming back to Professor remarks about cognition and so on, I think Aldous Huxley was the first to remark on that particular aspect of how it's when you let go of categories and so on, you then have you go to this other form where everything breaks down and also on the positive, after effects of that. It can not only be produced by drugs, I think it is masculine, but you can now produce it by transcranial stimulation of the brain and the nerves. So it's accessible to most people if they want it. You were sort of saying that, you know, it should become almost a political goal to make sure more people have these experiences. Do you think that if it's done without artificial means, that would be, I mean, that is something which would have a kind of in the long term, maybe for society, which you're hoping for?
In a word, yes. And at the same time, I'm quite aware of many pitfalls in that kind of a social agenda, beyond the pure hubris of it. But it seems to me an entirely logical proposition, something to be considered, how to be studied, you know, in the scientific sense, I don't really know. But that there, that a lot of our social life is driven by what I call the Armageddon complex, a basic framework of approaching differences of opinion in terms of demonization, that is, that the other party is, in some sense, irredeemably evil, and the second part of it being, the holiness of conflict, vengeance, even. And the third part being some kind of a total solution, that is, good guys defeating bad guys. And as you know, that has driven an awful lot of the political history of the 20th and 21st century, is doing so right now. And I think that that is a mindset which is not entirely genetically driven, and that there are alternative ways of thinking about differences of opinion, for example, and of dealing with other people that are in some sense congruent with these kinds of experiences. Yeah, Steve.
I don't know to what extent my question things have moved on after your sort of exchange with Nick, but you were earlier saying that you thought these experiences were universal, and I just wondered if you could clarify that. Because, I mean, you've also been saying that you think more people ought to have them, which implies that they're not.
Sounds kind of, yes. I think that sort of in the category of some things that we've talked about before, I think people may have experiences of this sort. Let me back up a bit and say, whatever kinds of experiences people may have seem to have some degree of insight, but they are also subject to being described within different social contexts. That is, a person who is a true believer of, you know, in the Mormon Church is going to very likely to define any experience of that sort in that context, and so forth.
What you're saying is that where those people happen, despite the kind of parochial references within each individual experience, there is a kind of universal content.
Yeah.
So it's not so much it's not to do with the population of owners being universal among humans, but rather that the owners of those experiences have a universal content.
Right. And there's also a good deal of evidence that people have many things that maybe many of us would qualify or categorize as religious experiences, even powerful religious experiences, but simply have nowhere to go with them. We can't assimilate, you know, kind of come back from the experience and assimilate that into their worldview in some sense or another. So they may even deny having had such an experience, or they may be socially or seriously psychologically disturbed in their attempt to handle it. So it comes back to some of my feeling that although the experiences may well be universal, they come in a great range. I think we would all agree to that. And we don't have a great repertoire of available wisdom out there in the world to most people to process any kind of experience of that sort that they might have. And they may just simply not know where to go with it. And or may just not communicate. The first time I had anything of that sort, it was in 1963. I just didn't talk about it for about 20 years. It seemed like it was a little weird. even though, as I now know, it was a fairly small scale.
Can I ask a sort of a related question?
Sure.
You think that they're beneficial in many respects, but are there not? I mean, would you like to say whether you think there are any dangers, any possible negative aspects, particularly if they were more widely distributed amongst the general population?
I think that there are dangers. And I also think that I don't know as much about that as I would like to. But clearly there have been, especially with relation to psychedelic drugs, that there are many cases where people are, you know, badly impaired by it. You might say morally impaired. I think we all know cases of people who have had brain damage, which rendered them less capable of functioning. I think that's the case with methamphetamines, that people become less in the ability to be responsible and to, you know, relate, empathize with other people and so forth. And I think it may well be the case with other kinds of experiences. I think the range of experiences that people have is astonishingly wide, and that our spectrum of even now, with all the centuries of religious scriptures and all the more recent scientific research and everything else, I think we're still looking at a fairly narrow chunk of the possible range of human experiences.
Yeah. I was thinking more of the possibility that if people have very strong experiences of this sort, it might actually lead to greater possibilities of conflict, because they might, because of certain ways that they interpret them, they may see themselves as being very different from other people, and that may lead to
Well, another piece of it, I think that if you, in many cases, people seem to have a kind of clarity of vision about social truths, received wisdom of, the commandments and the laws and all the rest of it, and see those as social constructions. And if you see the world that way, that could easily make you a very irresponsible person.
And can I relate to that?
Sure.
We finished the last presentation by discussing the necessity of a new language that would help us communicate. And now I would like to draw the attention to certain semantical details that are going on in this discussion. I mean, everybody is talking about having the experience, about the owner of the experience. And I believe that the way I understand it, that such experience happens when the whole sense of the owner or of the I that has the experience ceases to be. And so this is a really important thing.
That's a very good point. Yeah. You might more accurately say that the experience as you.
We should invent how to speak about it.
Yeah.
And from this, the whole thing about inducing these experiences is, in my view, totally misleading, because it's part of the same mental set that once somebody wanted to have some experience, and at best one can have a simulation of that experience, not really if one proceeds from this motivation of I wanted to have something. And I think this is a really crucial issue.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, my general feeling is that in a sense this is increasingly all out there, and that we have this sort of convergence of, our presence here is one piece of it, a convergence of religious traditions and spiritual traditions with scientific research, etc. And it is certainly not about to stand still. And at the same time, I have a feeling that there's a lot of need for these kinds of discussions and for some clarification of what we think on the subject area and what we think is doable and worth doing.
But to go further on from where I'm at, it's when you are there. So let's assume that you're in oneness. We are speaking of it now as it's like this is the reality, and this is just one part of this reality. But if I understand this correctly, if I was there, I would be laughing at this reality here and think, okay, that was a good approximation of, we could use it, but I mean, this is the reality. So, somehow we are not fair to this experience if we just discuss it without having it. Or, being there. I mean, no, both places.
I appreciate that. My own feeling is that we're not fair to the experience if we don't discuss it.
I've been thinking about it. There's something that's made me a little uneasy, and I think I have an idea what it is. The mystical traditions are mystical experiences are common in all traditions, but it's interesting that you don't find not so much this group or a small group, but if you go to the Tucson conference, for instance, you quite typically find representatives of the Buddhist tradition. To some extent, you find some representatives of the Hindu tradition. You don't very much find representatives of the other religious traditions.
Do you mean ministers? You mean like ministers or monks?
Yeah, I mean basically I'm thinking of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, the Western.
Well, I'm Christian, I was there.
I don't mean to say that the people who participate don't belong to religious tradition. But I mean the people who are presenting work or are are not saying, okay, this is what I understand about consciousness on the basis of my tradition. That's what I'm saying. Okay? Whereas you do find Buddhists who say, yeah, this is how we approach certain questions related to consciousness. You do find Hindus saying, this is how we approach certain questions related to consciousness. And I suppose that where that leads me is that, you know, when we're looking at is, after all, how does one go about studying consciousness? And, on the one hand, I'm very sympathetic. I mean, I have this statement that I've made that people have mentioned, and they're like, if you want to understand consciousness, the way to do it is to be conscious differently. And so then you say, okay, here's a mystical experience. That's being conscious differently. So now I'm able to understand something about consciousness. And yet I don't think that connection gets made in quite that way. And I think it's because there are, in certain traditions, it is important to understand consciousness. Whereas in other traditions, if you have an experience like that, you tend to talk about it in a very different language and a very different vocabulary. To some extent, a much more religious vocabulary. I don't mean to exclude, to say, well, so therefore we shouldn't be interested because we're interested in studying consciousness, we're not interested in, you know, having experiences of God. But I am wondering what the difference is.
I have a comment on that.
Yeah.
Just briefly. Well, I think one difference is your concept of how the personal fits into the universal. So, for example, if you see the universal as fundamentally impersonal, then you are in a position to talk, to think about different consciousness as being a different relation to an impersonal reality. Whereas, for example, in Christianity, the watchword there is to pray constantly, to pray continually. Mm-hmm. So that's a radically different way of being conscious. To be, in other words, the objective is to be in continual person-to-person contact with the personal aspect of reality.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, I think, an example of being conscious differently. And why it doesn't come up at Tucson is interesting, I think. You know, and I think that's probably, you know, I guess it would be probably kind of what Walt was indicating, a fundamentally anti-religious bias in among the scientific community that would cause you to be reluctant to say I pray or something like that.
Well, or maybe a more neutral way of saying that is I'm not presenting a position here, I'm just trying to respond to what you say. Maybe a more neutral way of saying that would be to say, if the approach you have for understanding consciousness is to be is more devotional and to pray more, it's difficult for someone who's not already ready to step into that tradition to know what to do with that. Whereas if the approach is to meditate more, let's say, you can at least say, well, okay, maybe it's hard to learn how to meditate, but I could imagine how to do that, or I could imagine that I might do that. But I can't imagine, you know, how I could give my life to God.
But I think the fundamental issue is one that could be discussed in Tucson, which is our primary relationship with reality personal to impersonal, or could it be personal to personal? And because that talks about, is consciousness a very localized within the soul phenomenon, or is it a panentheistic sort of thing that tunes into within our souls, but actually is a universal phenomenon? So, I mean, that would be, I think, a legitimate topic.
Yeah, and that does get talked about some at least. I think it's panentheist, as I recall, pretty.
Let me just mention one little thing, that because I'll forget it if I don't, is that just as an observation, I think one of the things that we're dealing with here is that there are an awful lot of you might call them different communities of belief with their own various paradigms and taboos, scientific, religious, etc., that tend to that tend to fence off discussion of what we're talking about here, or fence it in into very limited frames of reference. I was just recently reading Thomas Kuhn's postscript in the third edition of the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he talks about the sort of the psychosocial pressures of conformity to a group and the resistances to deviating from a group's perceptions, not just beliefs, but that he's kind of exploring that people actually see the same things as other people in their scientific community might see, and he also points out that that's a very healthy thing from an evolutionary point of view, that probably many civilizations, tribes certainly, had to more or less see the same things when they were struggling, you know, to hunt for an elephant or whatever. Nevertheless, those kind of ways of being conditioned are very prevalent, I think, are part of what makes it difficult to really get cross-boundary discussion about this. Excuse me.
Yeah, just to follow up on what Jack was saying, because this experience is probably the most powerful experience that you can have, if you already belong, if you already have a certain belief system, if you're, you know, then you tend to interpret it in the context of that. So, you know, for a Christian, it might be union with God or with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for somebody else, they will interpret it differently. So, actually, there are these 14 characteristics that I mentioned which are common to all the experiences all across cultures. But there is one characteristic which is differently interpreted. And that is, how do you interpret the fact that, let's say, here is I and here is the other, or the rest of the world, or, you know, everything else, and they unite. That's what the experience is. Now, you can interpret it in maybe two or three different ways. One is that you are uniting with the body of something external to you, which is, you interpret as God. Or you can say that God, that everything else is coming into you and you become the universe. And in many traditions, this interpretation is heretical. I mean, you have, in the monotheistic traditions, you have mystics who have been kind of burned at the stake because they said something like this. Eckhart in Christian tradition, you have, Bayezid in Sufi tradition. I mean, they said things like, I am God, or, you know, equivalent of that, which is, whereas in Buddhism and Hinduism, you know, these statements are not heretical. I mean, you have Sanskrit formulas. There's a formula, Shivoham means I am Shiva, or Brahmasmi, I am Brahma. So, in, for example, in Hinduism, you have what is known as monism, which is different from the Western philosophical monism, which basically means that the mystical experience is expressed as the whole world uniting with you, and you become God. Then there's dualism, which is there in the Bhakti traditions, which is, you know, the devotional traditions, which is exactly like, you know, the monotheistic traditions of the West, which is that you never say that I become God, but that I unite into God. And there are in-between traditions, which, you know, which is known as qualified monism, which kind of try to bridge both of them. So I think how you interpret it depends on what tradition you belong to.
Yeah, as you were listening to that, I thought of Martin Buber and his I and Thou concepts, and he was against people defining themselves as being oneness with others. He thought that the moral requisite for entering into an I and Thou relationship is that you're aware of your separateness,
right,
from somebody,
right,
else,
right,
and you deal with that.
Yeah, that is the middle tradition where you unite and yet you're aware of your separateness.
Right. So. Mark Buber was kind of an early, yeah, mid-comfort, yeah. disciple, I guess.
And so actually this experience can support all, I mean, it can support monotheistic, or pantheistic, any interpretation. So that part of the experience is kind of variable across cultures, but the rest of the characteristics are the same.
Susan, and then...
Well, I find the whole emphasis on religious experience a little discomforting. I spent a lot of time a long time ago reading Plotinus and Lucretius. Lucretius is De Rerum Natura and Plotinus is Aeneid. And neither of them, although they have been used by various other religious traditions, neither of them are religious. Per se, but I don't really, and it's still possible to have a oneness with Plotinus.
Right, and that's
so
it's partly definitional. I mean, we don't quite seem to get it in the West that there are non-theistic religions. That it is not necessary to have a belief in God in order to be a religious person or have religious experiences. Nick has had the first, and then we get one.
Yes, I haven't understood you to be using religion in this non-supernatural sense. I was very interested in what you said about the possible risks of this kind of experience becoming too common. Maybe it's universal, maybe, and we all are capable of it, and you'll experience it at times, but the risks of experiencing in uncontrolled ways. It made me think, I mean, as we were talking about, the question of how it must have looked from the point of view of evolution and natural selection, given it sounds as if this must be a good thing. We're all capable of it, I think you're right about that. And therefore the question is, then why not just get on with it and have these experiences and love everybody and feel on a picture and be happy and so on. And the answer must be that actually it has to be controlled. It can only be appropriate in certain contexts. So to do this promiscuously would not work, and that you must, in the past at least, it must have been beneficial to have it in the right company, one of the right people, and with the right context in general, which of course will not be provided by drugs and things. It would have been brought on by social cues and by and stimulus to the right kind of rituals and so on.
Rituals
being part of rituals at least in later stages. And it might be a very parallel thing in relation to healing. As the placebo effect demonstrates, we all are capable of self-cure from almost every illness on the other side. Placebo cure is cure which comes about by us using resources already within ourselves. And the great paradox about the placebo effect from an evolutionary point of view, I've written about this, is that given that we can make ourselves better, then why don't we just do it? Why do we need to get permission from a doctor or a shaman or somebody, some outside sources, or a sugar coach, tells us now it's okay to deploy your own healing resources? And the answer in the case of healing is that in the past at least, deploying one's healing resources promiscuously, just throwing everything you've got against an invading microbe, whatever it is, or getting rid of pain simply because you don't like it or whatever it is, would not have been adapted. Pain is valuable. Pain is functional. Getting rid of it when it's not appropriate is not a good idea. Not using all your resources when you get the flu or whatever it is, and making the illness therefore last twice as long as it might otherwise have done, again, is adaptive if you don't know what's coming down the pike next week. New resources are very expensive, you can't renew them quickly, and so on, you need to keep stuff in reserve. And so on the whole, nature has given us what I call a health management system, which takes account of all the information about the company we're keeping, what the future holds, what the weather's like, what food resources are, and so on, and then manages our healing resources appropriately. And it's only when it's safe to do so that we actually then we cure ourselves, and basically what procedures are doing, giving us the signal that now it's safe to do so. Now, I think it would be very interesting to think about what you're talking about, these experiences of numinous flow and so on. Again, exactly in which context will it be safe to deploy them, in fact beneficial and wonderful to deploy them, and under which will it not be? And to think about this in an historical context, because while you're right that, you know, we seem to be, we kind of need more of this stuff, more of these experiences, not to understand the problems that might arise would actually would be a big mistake. And just as it's true that, you know, placebo medicine seems to be a good thing, it isn't always going to be. You're giving someone a snake oil to kill another one, in fact they need the illness, or whatever, mm-hmm. they can't afford to use their resources and they're not safe, is actually dangerous to them. So I very much like the course, a wonderful presentation, and it raises lots of interesting issues about, you know, checks and balances on doing good even within one's own resources. Yes.
But before we get to Wendell, I'd just like to say kind of that I essentially agree with what you said, but I'd like to put in somewhat different words. I wouldn't say so much that we need controls on religious experience, but I think we need a whole lot more maturity and growing up evolutionary development, including all religions. I mean, we tend to forget, the things that we have fenced off out there in the world have got to be alive and developing. Or they shouldn't be around. Everything has got to be, in some sense, maturing, and I think everything has a long way to go in that regard, and certainly global civilization does. And at the same time, global civilization is a reality, in my opinion, at this point. Second thing, in terms of that kind of final solution mentality about health or anything else, some of the, I've been reading some of the history of the emergence of the Armageddon complex out of Zoroastrianism, and that Norman Cohn, at least, you're probably familiar with his work, says that prior to the emergence of Zoroastrian theology, ancient civilizations mostly lacked any concept of ultimate good and evil, and a final battle. They seem to be more in the shit happens sort of frame of mind, that there are things you got to cope with. And that somehow we seem to have bought in on a global scale to this concept of good and evil, and we got to clean it all up somehow. And in the words of our president in the post 9/11 thing, that, you know, the answer of what we need to do is clear. We have to end evil in the world. I mean, that's a hell of a game. but seriously, that's a frame of a conceptual frame that I think is very widespread. Wasn't always there, and it's very dangerous.
I'm going to continue a number of these things in my own presentation, but I just want to bring out one thing at this stage. I think we need to be much more careful about using either ultimate or penultimate language in talking about these kinds of experiences. I think particularly when you get into discussions of flow or Maslowian peak experiences, there's an awful lot of these experiences seem to be much closer, much more continuous with everyday experience, and sometimes is implied in this religious language. Mm-hmm. And religious language, I think, illuminates the fact that people have these experiences seems to be clear. Doesn't seem to be clear, it's clear. The challenge seems to be more in terms of how we interpret the meaning of those experiences. And those experiences seem to get interpreted, as Pradeep said earlier, in almost every conceivable language. I just want to give an example of a kind of interpretation that we haven't even alluded to. If you read a book like Gorky's Mother, I mean, Gorky is talking about the collapse of self-hatred and alienation in a factory town, I believe it was Leningrad, but it might have been outside of Moscow, and how liberating the communist ideology, the Marxist ideology, was to create brotherhood, energy, a sense of unity that allowed people to transcend that. And my only point there is, it's just another language, another interpretation of what is the meaning of these kinds of experiences. And it seems to me that's our biggest problem. We get trapped into what is our interpretation of what they're meaning.
Yeah. Well, you're quite right. I mean, there's big time babble going on here in terms of the many definitions and languages and traditions that are being drawn up and so forth in the in the conversation, and that it can be in many ways misleading and dangerous. I just, as I've indicated, think that at this point it would be more dangerous not to try to accelerate it and hopefully add some clarity to it. I think that wraps it up for me. Thanks all of you for your contributions to my thinking.
Well, let's think about a 10-minute break.
Use my glass coffee. That's right. I'll get it.
I can cover the cough, but I'll lay down for a minute in the woods.
That might work.
I'm just going to start, okay? So, I had originally hoped to be one of the last presenters. Because what I really wanted to do in this presentation was I wanted to I wanted to sort of make the presentation a little bit more freewheeling and trying to underscore some of the inevitable tensions that seem to arise in any discussion of first-person inquiry. So I'm amazed at how many of those tensions we've already brought up in the first day of this gathering. So I felt a little bit more free to just talk a little bit today. I think one of the tensions is that between those of us who have gone into the subject, I would say, from the perspective of self-transformation, which I would say would very much include people who come to this more from the perspective of meditative practices, of contemplative practices, of body activity, and those who are coming to this more as scientists and trying to bring some degree of scientific objectivity, or wondering whether some kind of scientific objectivity can be brought to the subject. And I think for myself, I've actually waxed back and forth between those two poles quite a bit. I think that's probably not just true of me. But I certainly did originally get into this whole kind of introspective area, which really goes back to a certain night in November of 1967. And I won't go into what that all was about, but it did have an experiential component. It had a kind of ontological shift that happened in me in a matter of moments. People thought I was a different person the next day, and they would talk about me as having had a conversion crisis. So that wasn't my language, but the reality was it didn't come out of anything like a death experience, but it did come out of a tremendous amount of tension on everything from intellectual levels to the Vietnam War to the attempted suicide of a family member, and it all came at once. So that probably brought me into a way of looking at life which at least initially fell into the more mystical kind of Eastern worldviews, or at least I found them more compatible with the way I was looking at things. And I would say the first stage was trying to re-invoke that or understand that, and that was kind of the how to get enlightened era, I think, is the way it plays out in many people's minds. But I think, you know, most of the ways of getting enlightened, or at least the initial practices people have, at some point you realize, without having this language, that you're really just trying to woo your neuroplasticity into an anticipated state of mind that you believe is the one you should have. And underlying it are all kinds of other complicated motivations that are taking place. Whether you're really trying to get enlightened or get girlfriends or have a community because you're lonely, or have power over other people because it looks like these other people who are getting away with being enlightened seem to have that. You know, there's a lot of confusion going on in that, and I think so. That's one aspect. The other aspect is getting enlightened from the perspective of any practice, whether it's mantra, meditation, or breathing, or Sufi dance, or whatever, becomes a kind of confrontation, struggle, engagement with thought processes which seem to be pulling you in other directions. And a question that arises in one form or another, what are all these thoughts and what do they want? Why are they constantly distracting me? Why am I getting caught up in them? Why can't I concentrate on my mantra or my breathing practice or my body movement or whatever my approach is? You know, what's going on here? And so that often sets in motion a kind of shift, which may initially go to a repression of thought or a struggle with thought, but eventually moves more toward a kind of inquiry in what are these thoughts, what do they want, but also a kind of still transformatory engagement, which is largely about, well, how do I dismantle them? Because I'm still trying to get to those states of mind that, at least within those vocabularies, seem to be either transcended, meaning transcending our basic orientation, or as some of us have probably been questioning much more in recent years, whether those are preconceptual states. In other words, whether they relate to states of mind which may be actually more close to what some of our animal ancestors are perceiving than our more intellectual, conceptual way of engaging our world. And I'm using that preconceptual not in a pejorative sense. I mean, I talked about that last year quite a bit, so I'm not going to get into it so much, because I think there is a question about what our whole conceptual capacity is in relationship to our evolution and our continuity with our the great apes or other ancestors that we want to look at. Now, we humans make a great deal about this conceptual capacity, and we often talk as if it's not only what distinguishes us, which seems to be very important, but distinguishes us from other animals, but it's also what makes us special. It's why there is nothing like a man or a dame, or whichever way we want to go with that. But it's also quite possible that it was just an adaptive skill, another toolkit that was overlaid on an actually fairly well-developed biological entity, fairly well-developed organism, and perhaps we should look at it as one more tool rather than the end-all and be-all of what it means to be a human. A remarkable tool, and certainly a tool that has allowed us all forms of adaptation and cultural evolution that do not seem to be so evident in other species, but nevertheless a tool. So I went into this engagement with my thoughts area for a while, engagement with motivations, and then in the more scientific aspect, there was this attempt to deal with, well, what really are thoughts? What are feelings? What's their relationship to the act of perceiving, being aware, conscious, and the various states of mind we can have, and how subtly the states of mind shift relative to one's thought processes, one's breathing processes, one's movement. And so that became a kind of more scientific inquiry, a kind of attempt to model in a more universal sense what's taking place. But it's also very problematic whether we're doing anything more than a crude modeling because we want to pass on some ideas to somebody else, because maybe if they get what we think we understand, they'll be able to have what we think we have or don't have. I mean, it's a very complicated process, and it's what I tried to bring out a little bit earlier this morning. It also seems to be not a totally objective process in any way, because any engagement with one's thoughts, feelings, perceptions is also a transformatory process. So you're still in that scientific transformatory bind that goes on and on.
And I mean, the simple reality seems to be, if we use our more present scientific models of mind, that every act of awareness, every act of perception, is itself altering mental states, altering mental capacities, either in terms of a kind of connectionist model where you're reinforcing links between feelings and memories, or even in a kind of more therapeutic cathartic sense where if you can engage underlying mental structures or physical structures, you may actually be able to diffuse them. But either way, you get into some kind of transformatory dynamic there. More recently, this whole inquiry for me has become much more focused on the last question up there, which is, how do we know, or can we know, what is right, good, or just? And it's, well, I'll come back to that. But I think the bottom line of that is that each of us is an entity, an animal, a nexus of consciousness, and a sea of relationships. I mean, we all have slightly different ways of talking about this and which what we want to emphasize in it. Whether we want to emphasize the aloneness of it, I'm not saying the loneliness of it, I'm saying the aloneness of it, or whether we want to emphasize the social engagement or relational dimensions of it. But each of us is, you know, an entity who, to the extent that we're under our own will, is trying to make sense of our world and figure out what we should do in relationship to it, how we should respond to it, how we should spend or orientate ourselves in relationship to it, how we should engage it, what behaviors and actions we should take, what we should think about it. But thinking about it, I think most of us understand it's more than thinking about it, it's molding our relationship to it. So we all know the Necker cube, though everybody doesn't know it as a Necker cube. So, what's the right way to look at this? Is the front-facing surface the one in the southeast? Or is the front-facing surface the one in the northwest? Is there a right way to look at this cube? What kind of cube is it, really? Well, I've spent a lot of time with the Necker cube. I sort of love this cube. It's one of, it's sort of been a little contemplative exercise for me over the years. Now, I don't know that I have a lot of original things to say about it, but in my kind of quiet contemplative states, I like to just kind of look at this and let my mind go from one orientation to the other orientation, to the one orientation to the other orientation, and sort of try and be aware of what's happening, what's going on, what's invoking the one orientation or the other orientation. And is there a shift from one to the other? Or is it more like you can only see one of those orientations at a time? Or can you somehow invoke both of them at the same time? I find it very difficult to invoke both of them at the same time. It seems to be one orientation or the other orientation. And most of us would, let me just finish that and then I'll come to your question. Most of us, you know, won't necessarily say there's a right orientation, but what is the reality here? Well, the reality is there's no cube at all. Right? The reality is black lines are white tape. That's the materialistic reality of we've got, what we've got here.
Well, it's not black lines or white paper, it's lines, black lines of light.
Black lines of light. I'm black paper. It gets hard to be totally materialistically specific at this point. But I think you all get the point of what I'm saying here. And it's not a cube at all. It's a representation of a cube. Not only that, when we see a cube, whether it's an upwardly facing or downwardly facing cube, that is an overlay of our Platonic cubedom on this representation, or the overlay of our representation on these lines. But we always have the problem. That's not the materialistic explanation, but what ontological status do we want to give to the vision of that as a cube? If it's not, it's materialistic reality, but it's representational reality. Okay, just throwing it out there, just a few of these questions.
There are actually three perspectives to that.
Yeah, there are. But most people go between those two. You were going to say something.
I was going to say that not all. I know of at least one person who does see both Southwest and Northeast at the same time. I'm quite sure that that's an accurate description of her phenomenon.
Yeah. And I can believe that. I'm just saying for myself, I see that. Shift. I don't get them both at the same time, but I can quite imagine that somebody could. I mean, people smell colors and all kinds of strange things. So obviously we have different mental structures that we're each working with. So koan. So basic koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping? But there are also a lot of questions that function like koans, such as, can thought know what a thought is? And these questions, which can be posed intellectually in an inquiry mode, and most of the talks I gave for about 10 years of my life were sort of deconstructing questions like this, I didn't always know where the talk would go, how the talk would unfold, but I sort of knew where we were always going to get to. And where we always got to was sort of the mind recognizing the limitations of the conceptual frameworks it was engaged in and moving into a state of relative, if not absolute, silence. And in most of the rooms, I remember talking in this way, and other people who have used similar approaches, the silence becomes palpable. It becomes shared by the end of the talk. So there are questions like that that function like koans, questions that seem to force the conceptual framework to have to engage the limitations of what it can know conceptually and take one into a state of, I'll say, not knowing or grace or just the question of whether perception now can reveal some content that was not revealed through a conceptual representation. What does it mean to know? Well, I think this is a fairly obvious point. But the point is, what do we mean by knowing anything? Talking about conceptual knowledge, perceptual knowledge. So all of you know this word, grokking?
Mm-hmm.
Grokking was a big word in the 1960s. It was used in a novel by Heinlein called Stranger in a Strange Land. And it sort of was a word that represented something that we really didn't have in the English language, which was somehow you just get it, you know, on a bodily, you understand what something means. The Martian hero in this gets what jokes are. He doesn't understand jokes at all throughout the whole novel. And finally he gets it, he goes into hysterics for days, I think the way the novel goes. And his getting it is that there's a violence or hurt to somebody in every joke. So other forms of knowing are not that you know it conceptually, but you are transformed by that knowledge, and then they're the more ultimate forms of wisdom or enlightenment, or supposedly that we come into a kind of knowing that's very transcendent. Oh, can I go back? Yeah, good. Syntax and semantics. We were talking about this a little bit yesterday. There's fully half of us here who are engaged in looking at questions of robotics and in what ways robots are similar or dissimilar to us human beings, and thinking very deeply about those questions. And for some, it's about the issue of whether robots can be conscious. For others, it focuses more on John Searle and his Chinese Room, and whether a robot which is engaged in, or a computer which is engaged in syntactical processing, can really understand anything. And for others, myself, I'm kind of very caught up in a project of thinking through, can the robots make moral decisions? Or how will we implement moral decision-making faculties in robots? And I think for all of us, this was a rich thought experiment because it gets us a little bit out of a carbon-based machine mentality and talks a little bit about, well, if we really are machines that evolution has wrought, can that be substantiated, at least in principle, within machines that we create? So it's a wonderful thought experiment. It's a wonderful way of thinking very deeply about how we may be similar or fundamentally different from any machine that we might create. And the Chinese Room captures that. Well, the Chinese Room, for those of you who don't know it, the Chinese, is there anyone who doesn't know the Chinese Room here? So please feel free to say it out. Seems everybody has a basic understanding of it. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the Chinese Room. But the point of the Chinese Room is, Searles is saying, syntax does not equal semantics. Engaging in syntactical mechanical processes does not yield understanding. And that's his basic intuition. And for him, this is very simple, obvious. You know, he thought when he gave his first talk, everybody would nod, and yeah, he didn't know what else to say, but that's what he was going to say. And as most of you know, this is one of the most raging philosophical debates out there, where, in effect, there are thousands of papers where people are arguing in one form or another about flaws in Searle's argument, or about how cumulative syntactical processes become semantic understanding. And the other way of looking at that may be saying, well, we don't understand anything. We're living in a world of metaphors. We have descriptions upon descriptions upon descriptions, and we run around within, you know, a world of illusory meaning created by these associations we make. So, is semantics just a complex syntactical game? The scientist and the mystic. Here's the other tension I want to get into, and Walt did a wonderful job of opening the door for this one. The scientific perspective, and I'm not saying all scientists are going in this, but there's a tension you particularly feel at Tucson between those who sort of see thought as the central concern in consciousness. And the thought, self-awareness, metacognition is required for consciousness. And therefore, we humans are conscious because we have those capacities whereby there's no absolute evidence that animals do. Yes, there are some great chimps, and there have been two dolphins and a couple of other animals that have passed the Gallup self-recognition. There are self-recognition tests. There's one gorilla which may or may not have demonstrated metacognition, but at least the guru of metacognition, Peter Carruthers, is not convinced. So this really distinguishes us, and you can't have consciousness unless you are aware of being aware. So self-awareness, metacognition is central for consciousness. The other is the more idealistic spiritual worldview, sometimes a panpsychic worldview, which is thought is a byproduct or a distortion or a diminution of consciousness. And the more scientific perspective is consciousness is in me, it's an emergent property from all my mental apparatuses. And the panpsychic view is more that I'm in consciousness in some sense. And the view of spiritual experiences, often as being ultimate or penultimate, is that I come into an awareness of that. Or for some reason, those experiences tend to lend themselves very quickly to that interpretation. Whether that's implicit in that interpretation or whether those interpretations are conceptual, or whether in the availability of those interpretations within our cultures, we naturally turn to them, that's a much more complicated story. So the frame problem. Am I in consciousness or is consciousness in me? And if I'm in consciousness, not I'm in consciousness, I'm a nexus in the sea of relationships which is consciousness or which is the manifest world, then of course where do I stop, where do I start, what is me, what is not me? So, another contemplative exercise I like to perform a lot is going to scenic locations. So last year when I was here, we had the cabin right next door, and I used to get up early in the morning and sit in the porch and take in this lovely panoramic view out there. And one of the things that happens in this panoramic view is I want to know, well, is it a product of thought or is it something that is independent of my thinking process? So I often will try and go into a quasi-meditative contemplative state and kind of diffuse my thinking too much. And there's a sense of being submerged in this panorama. The panorama is a description I often have after the fact. And the question is even though there are different colors and there are different qualities, how specific is that panorama until I think about a particular aspect and relate it to my my working memory? In what sense is this radically different from, I'll use the camera metaphor, even though none of us would say camera has a phenomenological experience, but is it something more than just content, sensory content, registering within my mechanisms? Or does it have very specific content without my thinking about it? My sense is there is that awareness, there is that phenomenological experience, but it actually doesn't have very much content until I give attention to or focus on one aspect or another, and then retrieve memory concept or whatever that's stored and related to that aspect that I'm focusing on. So the phenomenology is almost, is not even qualia as much as it is a generalized awareness. And the qualia dynamic often only comes into play when I focus on a particular aspect that has drawn my attention, and it is now invoked through the thoughts, the feelings, the associated mechanisms that attach to that. So that's just, I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm just, this is a contemplation I do very often, and it's ongoing. I'm just sharing with you some of my reflections.
Could it just be the acuteness of a particular qualia rather than there is no qualia there beforehand?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I just can't say. Mm. You know, I mean, the real difficulty with these kinds of problems, well, maybe I'll come back to what the difficulty is. If I don't remember if I have another. No, let me come back to it again. So, mystical experiences, and I'm not even going to get into the broad mystical category, just a simple mystical category where you feel, rather than in an objectified relationship to the world, where I look at you as outside of me. And when I do that in my meditation, I mean, it's that objectiveness, I really have a feeling of just a tension built in the back of my head, a center that I am functioning from. I am this center here, objectifying the world out there, and you are out there. So when I become aware of that tension, and in that awareness, diffuse it, don't reinforce it, you know, catharticize it, I mean, the different ways of relating to each of those centers, which I think in the Indian iconography is the thousand-petal lotus, all the different centers you can look from, you can look at, with, into, beyond, different orientations, different psychologies, different ontologies in relationship to that world around you. Or you can move into trying to defuse or not really functioning from any center, or even sense of self so strongly, and then you have more of that flow, organic, oneness, you know, that you are a nexus in the sea of relationship is kind of the language I like for it. Now, the one thing that didn't come up in Walt's talk at all is when you're in that state, is that state, using Pradeep's language, a more ultimate state, our true nature that's being distorted by our conceptual mental apparatus, or is that state of science, is that state an illusion? You know, why would natural selection make states like that available to us? What evolutionary function do they serve? And I sat with that, trying to look at what happens when I have this feeling, not just that consciousness is in me, but I'm in a sea of consciousness. Or maybe it's just a sea of energy, but why does it seem like a sea of consciousness, and consciousness just within here, and stuff the way the apparatus perceives energy and dynamics? Or is that, is there really that quality, kind of psychism? Is the universe alive? Is it conscious in some sense? Or is consciousness an expression of some quality of matter that we don't fully understand? A la Roger Penrose, maybe it's an expression of massive quantum entanglement. And the problem is, I've contemplated this question and contemplated not in an intellectual sense, trying to be quiet in what can I perceive. And the problem is I also know too much science. And I can't come up with a conclusion one way or another. I'm not sure that perception functions at that level. We know that neurotransmitters jump synaptic gaps at roughly 1 millisecond. Roughly 1 millisecond. It also appears, using models of consciousness like Bernie Bauer's global workspace theory, which is probably one that has the most universal acceptance, but certainly not universal acceptance, broadest acceptance, I guess would be the right language. And for those of you who don't know that theory, he's basically saying, well, there's a tremendous amount of input and perceptual input, and the mind is creating these associations, and you've got all this input, and they're all competing for attention. They're competing to come into consciousness, and from consciousness, they are whatever comes into consciousness, whatever wins that competition, whatever draws our attention, is then broadcast to the whole brain in search of resources in order to determine more or less what to do next. But the problem is when you look at even those models scientifically, we're talking about one mental cycle, one cognitive cycle, and it looks like there's somewhere between 5 to 10 of those in every second. 5 to 10 things win over consciousness, attention, within 1 second. So if that's the case, and I'm not absolutely saying that's the case, but the model that Stan Franklin is developing with Bernie Bears is based on that. If that's the case, then conscious perception is happening more or less at a rate of 200 milliseconds, maybe 100 milliseconds. But synaptic firings are happening at a rate of 1 millisecond. So I'm not really trying to go into this in great depth, and we can talk about it more, but the problem is, I don't know how I would know whether the world was conscious or whether consciousness was my perception of the world when I was in a quiet state just because of the richness of the mental phenomena that was being fired on a synaptic level. So I don't have an answer to that. I'm just trying to talk about the scientific dialogue versus the self-transformatory dialogue. So the problem is I've looked at most of these things from both sides now. I'm not sure which of our intellectual disputes are real or a product of structures of mind, conceptual frameworks, through which we look at things. Which of our intellectual disputes are functional byproducts of the structure of mind, of the structure of thought, and which are truly substantial? Is consciousness a functional illusion or phenomenal reality? Is there a conceptual limitation in the mind's ability to embrace the tension between two or more different perspectives? Is there a right answer? Now, I said to you that for me, this has become an ethical question. It's no longer a philosophical question. Because there are certainly ethical issues with our insurmountable gaps. And you know that either both parties are wrong. It's not just a matter of relativity, who's right and who's wrong. But an awful lot of our tension seems to hang on these very subtle shifts in the way we look. I listened to a scientist talk about consciousness as an emergent property or functional consciousness, or I listened to Dan Dennett talk, and I do feel he's not explaining consciousness, he's explaining consciousness away. But I also listened to him talk and said, sounds pretty good. Got some great arguments there. And then somebody else comes along and they say, but what about experience? And I say, yeah. And those arguments go back and forth, and within their own frame of references, both sides seem to be pretty complete. And my problem is, I can look at it from both sides, and I don't know what I believe. So how much of our differences are really the differences in the shifts of how things look based on the ontological or conceptual framework or overlay we are putting in them, and which are real issues? And is the problems that we face in life, how much of them are really insurmountable gaps, and how much of them are a function of the fact that we are very poor at holding the tension? And the tension is that we're in the neckerchief. It's black lines on white paper, but it looks slightly different depending upon the structure of mind through which you look at it. Now, a little bit of what I talked about last year was my silent ethic, which is kind of my baby project right now. But the point I'm trying to make in this is, it seems to me there's something about the mechanisms of mind, the conceptual mechanisms of mind, that both make us prone to Paul Bloom's natural-born dualism, but also prone to confuse our conceptual structures with some notion of a capturable reality. And that when the concepts are very close to each other, when you're in the Necker cube, and it's just a question of a shift in perception, then in a certain sense, the truth lies in that space where your mind can come to rest, or you need to think about it can come to rest. And that's what I'm going to call the silent ethic. I'm not going into it in great detail, but I'm just saying that it may be something about choice, and what's right and wrong is about choosing where you don't need to think about something anymore. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Can I ask a very quick clarification question? I've never heard of groping, bopping.
Dropping.
Is it a choice or an epiphany? Is it the sort of Yeah,
I was pretty close. I saw you put that down, Susan. And I think it can be more mundane than that.
Yeah.
Because the example you gave was of, was it Michael? Getting very,
Michael Valentine Smith.
Yeah, getting very sort of excited about finding and understanding humor. But there are lots of cases where you can grok something relatively, you come into a room and just grok what's happening in the room.
So if you come into a room where people are arguing, you don't hear them arguing, but you feel the tension.
You're getting something below the conceptual level that you can think about.
I think somewhere in the book, if I remember right, I think it's Michael who said that the word really meant to drink.
Yeah, that's right. It's associated with scarcity of water on Mars. It's actually a water sharing ritual, which by metaphorical transference has come to mean understanding another person. And it's both, what's interesting about it is it's both cognitive and effective at the same time. The cognitive and the effective are cues. So you can't actually, you can't separate the understanding of the factual from the sort of accepting, realizing the beauty of at the same time.
So it could be an epistemological and bodily satiation.
The things you get it in some total way.
Understanding is your gut.
I haven't quite blocked it yet,
The lecture says that it's to understand profoundly and intuitively.
Doesn't happen
to
the joy
scene
of Epiphany.
Well, there goes language again.
Yeah.
What do you think it would take, what do you imagine it would take to push you toward one side or the other, or do you even, is that even desirable?
One side or another in relation to what?
In terms of the both sides, no. Dilemma that you face.
Well, I think the reality is, if we are, let's say, if we are a nexus of relationship and the world is living us rather than us living the world, then in a sense we move back and forth to one side or the other relative to what's needed. And probably all of us are constantly moving back and forth, just as I'm moving back and forth from a transformatory relationship to consciousness to trying to create some crude scientific model. So it seems to me that, in that sense, we're responsive beings, in the need-worrying sense of the responsive side. Responding to what the collective tensions, needs, forces, internal and external at play, demand of us in a particular moment. So, in this moment, I'm standing here. But in the next moment, I may be standing here. And it is not that there is a right side as much as each side is a perspective which is a manifestation of where you need to be in that moment. And it seems to me, from an ethical perspective, if we understood that about ourselves, we could take responsibility for being where we are. I'm a scientist, I'm a mystic, it doesn't matter so much. Without having to be arrogant about that being the only place that one can stay.
I can see how that fits some of your examples. I mean, it's fine to be a relativist if you want about certain issues you talked about, but then you came up towards the end saying, well, look, here's Dan Dennett, the explanation of consciousness, and let's say the state of Charles on the other side. Now, sometimes I see it one way, sometimes I see it another way. In that case, it's not okay to be a relativist and say, well, they may both be right, because they can't be, and they both know they can't be, and that's why they fight each other so hard.
I'm not a relativist. I want to be very clear here, I'm not a relativist.
But it sounds like it.
No, I understand. But I'm saying that we may be dealing with challenges that we're only, our conceptual framework only allows us to look at within that relativism. And that the truth lies within that space, within the very difficult to live tension or unlived space which I believe was a Joycean term, that lies between these competing perspectives. Though in a particular moment, it may be relativistic in the sense that I'm, you know, looking at it from this side, or I'm looking at it from that side.
So you're saying there's an ethical stand in which the conclusion we come to is that sometimes we look at it one way and sometimes we look at it the other. It's like the Necker cube, right?
I'm saying that there may be such a thing as holding the tension.
So this is
holding the tension as a... Holding the tension is one way of talking about it conceptually, not knowing, or understanding that you are in a space that is not graspable within the conceptual, within the structures of mind you have to play with, is, you know, another way, which plays into the spiritual language of surrender and letting go and letting God, and, you know, it's all within those invoking ways in which you suspend your interpretive relationship to. But you can't suspend that interpretive relationship until you get into that space where, you know, you are really Tweedledum and Tweedledee. I mean, the letting go within the framework of I'm Shiite or I'm Sunni, you know, becomes meaningless.
I'm going to come back to this. I don't actually think you're a relativist. I think that what you're presenting is kind of Aristotelian virtue ethics, and I think you'll probably find that rather amusing. But I think that...
Not necessarily.
Well, okay. Then it was your phrase, moving your neuroplasticity,
yeah,
into the kind of state in which you would be disposed to have the kinds of attitude or response to a certain sort of...
That you think you should be having.
That you should think you should. That's what Aristotle talks about with the disciplining of the virtues. We become more virtuous in acting virtuously. We move our neuroplasticity.
No, but I'm actually critical about that willing neuroplasticity. But I do think it's Aristotelian in another sense, which is that's where the mean lies.
Okay, but it's not necessarily a relativism.
Hmm?
It's not necessarily.
I don't think it is a relativism.
Absolutely.
I think relativism holds another meaning where you are, you know, everybody can have their perspective and all truths are true even though they are absolutely inconsistent. I mean, there is not a supernatural God and no God at all. You know, it doesn't work.
But you take the issue of what explains consciousness.
Right.
If you say, okay, you see these different perspectives to the answers to that question, what is the deep explanation of consciousness in terms of how does it fit into the material universe? To suggest that the answer may lie between the perspectives seems to me to create, you know, it makes it too easy. It means that we don't have to settle for something. It'd be like saying that, you know, between special creation and Darwinian evolution, you know, we don't have to arbitrate that. It could be somewhere in between.
You're solving that in an intellectual way, and I am not solving this in an intellectual way. It is much more difficult to not know. It is much more difficult to inhabit the space where I do not know and I am silent because I can't grasp it in that way than it is to take one position or another. And I think that's the difficulty of the human condition. The difficulty is we have created this whole conceptual toolkit which makes us such remarkable beings, but we are also addicted to it in the sense that we have to give descriptions within frameworks that are not describable within of things that are not describable within the frameworks that we're giving them. So is light a wave or is it a particle? How the hell should I know? You know? But within a particular mathematical language, it functions like a wave. It shows and experimentally it demonstrates properties of a wave. And within a different mathematical language, it shows properties of a particle. But the reality is, I don't know what the hell that is. You know? But I know that within those mathematical languages and within discrete things that can be measured within controlled scientific experiments, it shows behavior of both. And I just, I think the fascinating thing is our addiction and need for the comfort of a description that we identify with, and the problematic for the human psyche to live within spaces that it doesn't know. And when I say live within spaces that it doesn't know is not an endpoint. It is not, okay, I don't know, it's over. No. Doesn't know is an invitation to the psyche, or to God, or to grace, or to whatever you want to say, to reveal within my experience and mind something that will be revelatory and will fill in what I'm not seeing.
Let's see if I can express what's... it seems to me that people have a great tendency, to explain things. Partly it relates to mixed confabulation, whatever the hell it is. You see a certain pattern of stars in the sky, and you make up a story for it. And I think that as we get farther along, we know a whole lot more, but it begins to look like what we need to do with a lot of things is recognize that there are great spaces of mystery. There are things that we just can only explain in limited ways, the wave and particle, whatever. And what I'm suggesting is my personal feeling is that we are evolving to a place in the global knowledge society that we begin to recognize the necessity, the intellectual honesty of mystery, and perhaps to live with things that even as our science advances and technologies get better, that we are not going to find ultimate explanations about.
Well, it may be that it's something to do with the very structure of thought and mind. In the same sense as babies have natural children, according to Paul Bloom, seem to have this natural born dualism. In other words, they fall into that structure of explaining their experience. Mm-hmm. That we have the same problem, and that in the end, our conceptual frameworks are often built around emphasizing the importance of one element and looking at everything in relationship to that. But what always gets left out is what's way over here, or it gets diminished in terms of its importance. And my experience is most great intellectuals seem to compensate for that at some point in their life. So the example I've used to a couple of people this weekend is John Stuart Mill. He writes utilitarianism, and the problem with utilitarianism is obvious to anyone who looks at it is, okay, you got this, you got five people injured from the railroad accident, and you got one healthy person in your office, and if you cannibalize one healthy person, you can save the other five. Do you do it? So we all know that utilitarianism has that flaw. It has that weakness within it as being a central ethical principle. And so what did Mill do? He wrote a book that compensated for that weakness called On Liberty. And gives it a utilitarian rationalization, but you kind of feel that it is addressing the weakness. Now, I happen to view Nick's talk today in that form. He's done this remarkable work over the years on theory of mind and on the social nature of our consciousness and us as beings. And here today, he says, well, the problem is that overlooks the fact of our aloneness. And so today, he redresses that, and not just today, in another talk. But the fact is, in the end, do we have, either today, or back in what was it, 1986 or 76? 1976, do we have a complete vision, or do we have actually two closely related visions that frame a problem that is a lived challenge that cannot be elucidated conceptually, but can only be lived?
Very good, John. He's had his hand up a long time.
Okay. The question is very simple. Can you make moral decisions without first force and consciousness?
Okay, that goes to a very different place from where I've been,
You're going to say yes, functionally, aren't you?
No, that's the question. I'm trying to figure out how far you can get without consciousness. In other words, I mean, some of you may not know, but I'm writing a book, and I've taken a kind of leading role in a new field of inquiry known as machine morality or machine ethics. And it starts from where we are, not whether Arnold Schwarzenegger and his minion of Terminators are going to take over the world and how we're going to stop it, but it starts from where we are and the fact that we're building machines that are more and more autonomous, and in their autonomy they're making decisions that can't necessarily be predicted by the designers. And so how are they going to be able to evaluate or monitor or constrain their own behavior? And I think this is just an essential problem when we stop developing computer systems here, because we're at that stage. And so the question for me has become, well, initially these computer systems are going to function in fairly limited domains, and though we may not know exactly what they'll do in a particular context, they can be operationally moral in the sense that we can anticipate all the different kinds of parameters that they might encounter, and therefore we could program that. But that requires no consciousness. That's just kind of, a kind of extrapolation from what we can determine. But then you get into increasingly functional levels of morality, and then ultimately moral agency, as we humans fancifully believe that we might have it, or at least maybe some of us have it. We haven't done a great job demonstrating that. And the problem is, if you look at that, you start looking at, well, what kinds of contexts and what kinds of decisions and what kinds of ethical systems can be applied in these domains as these domains expand? And can you have moral agency without consciousness, and what purpose does consciousness serve in functionally serve in having moral agency? In other words, how much autonomy, how much freedom can these systems have if we don't find a way to also give them consciousness? And not only consciousness, you get into consciousness, theory of mind, semantic understanding, affective heuristics, emotions, sociability, it goes on and on. There's all these things that seem to be essential to human moral decision making that go above and beyond our simple Kantian deontological or consequentialist or Aristotelian moral philosophies that seem to be necessary or complementary, or at least some aspects of them have to be accommodated in a functional way. And I guess all I'm saying is, I don't know how far you get with that. I don't know how far you get with a machine that isn't conscious, but you want it to make more decisions.
The reason I asked the question in the context of the discussion going on is because of your method. If entertaining different views on a single issue is something that we have a monopoly on as the human species. I wonder if that's what makes us difficult. If you had only a single vision that Blake found so frightening in Newton, then morality evaporates.
You know, and I may be wrong, but I think most good ethicists, most people you think are sensitive to ethics, they're good because they can look at the problem, let's say, from a deontological perspective and from a consequentialist perspective. If your child comes to you and he asks you what's right, and sort of poses a question like that, you know, a question where he can, he looks at a challenge from at least those two, you know, fundamental ethical perspectives. You don't necessarily know what to tell your child is right or wrong, but you're thrilled to death that he's demonstrating that kind of sensitivity. So ultimately, efforts may not be, you know, knowing that, you know, this, whatever, that you embody the virtues, or that you, you know, that you are the Peter Singer of utilitarianism, or that you're the Kant of moral reason.
Wouldn't it be easier to instantiate a deontological reasoning system in a machine? If you were to have some way of specifying the categorical imperative.
Well, Isaac Asimov, and you're going to be surprised I'm going to Isaac Asimov, but when people think about robots and ethics, they think about the three laws of robotics, right? And pretty straightforward, you know, logical principles. He had to add a fourth one later on. And he wrote a whole series of stories, you know, just three simple things: obey human beings, don't hurt human beings, obey human beings, survive. And he made them hierarchical, so we didn't get these obvious, you know, conflicts between them. And then he wrote, I don't know how many stories, like 50 or 60 of them, robot stories. And every single one of them is about a breakdown with just these three simple, basically intuitive deontological principles. So I think it's pretty clear that rule-based deontology doesn't work very well. Kantian deontology, that's another thing. I've taught a course on this for 2 years at Yale. I'll teach it again this fall. One of the assignments I give the students is to pick an ethical system and talk about, you know, whether you could or couldn't implement it within a roadmap. And the first year I taught this, the vast majority of students went with ruling utilitarianism. And the last time I taught it, the majority of students went with Kant.
It seems to me that there are three different cases for your, you know, two things that you want to maintain tension between. The first is like the Necker cube, where there really are two different perspectives. And there's no, I mean, both of them are valid. The second one is when the two perspectives can never meet. Like, for example, Colin McGinn's idea that our conceptual system can never explain what, you know, how consciousness is achieved by the brain. Right. And the third one is, where there are two points of view, one of which, in principle, has to be right, and one has to be wrong, even though we don't know which one is right or wrong at this moment. Yeah. And it seems to me that your method of maintaining tension might work for the first two, but not for the last one, where we actually want more development of the two perspectives to finally figure out which one is right.
No, I think that's not true. I think when one's right and one's wrong, you are really when you know one's right and one's wrong, but you don't know which, that's when you're truly holding your tension. You see, the problem is I'm not consciousness. I'm an embodied being. And that tension is ripping me apart. And it's really in that state where you have the ability to almost, I don't know if I can go into this in, you know, just a few minutes, but I think it's in that state that you have the ability to will a unity without necessarily conceptually knowing what that unity is that you will. But that's hard. It's much easier to wish you had never seen.
Well, in that spirit, I want to say that I have a model that tries to combine Bernie Barr's global workspace theory and mystic experience.
Well, aren't you going to do a presentation? I thought when I asked you a few weeks ago what you might talk about here, you said you might talk about that.
I could, yeah.
But I mean, you have a space to make a presentation, so it may be that that would be, unless you have something else you want to do, that might be the time to take a few minutes and go into a greater detail.
Sure.
Can I just follow up on Pradeep's making? I think you didn't answer. We did answer it by saying no. You don't have to make a choice between two alternatives, even if one is...
No, you may have to make a choice.
When we take Richard Gregory a long time ago made a real like a cue, rather wide, you know. And the fact is that if you just look at it hanging against the wall, it's still reversible all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But one of those perspectives is wrong, and one, in fact, is right, because this is a real 3D object. Mm-hmm. In that case, you know, it's one may not be able to decide, but there is an answer. And one of the respects you're capable of taking is, in fact, the correct one, if you don't know it. In the case, let's say, of David Chalmers and Daniel Dennett, you're saying actually neither of them has got it right. And therefore, we shouldn't feel forced to choose between those two perspectives on consciousness, because the truth actually will lie somewhere different. Now,
actually, I would say that about Brooklyn. But that's a different conversation. I think Dan Dennett has set this thing up, you know, where I'm on this team and I lead this football team, and if Chalmers leads that football team, I think they're both flawed, but that's a wholly different discussion. I mean, I would say that,
you seem almost to be arguing for the kind of moral virtue of maintaining this tension and not coming down, even when there is a right decision, and not even wanting to find it. That somehow we're better off in this in-between stage. It's a more human state. It's more.
Well, I'm going to go to two places on this. Okay. I mean, I think there is a moral virtue of holding the tension and not taking sides when there's no clarity. I think it is truly a virtue to recognize when something is not clear,
mm-hmm.
and hold that tension until a clarity has revealed itself to you.
But then should you resist the clarity, because you move away from that?
No, I'm not energizing tension. I mean, I think that's what I was trying to talk about in body being. I'm a body. I need to be integrated. I need to flow. I need to respond. So my whole raison d'etre is trying to make sense of this world in a way where I can function and make decisions that will not rip me apart. That's the ethical, that's the embodied ethical drama I'm involved in. And as a part of the community of men or women or society or whatever we've got here, I think I'm part of the dialectic where culture is working through whatever tensions are on the plate today, whether that's the Iraq war or whatever else we want to be dealing with. So I think that's an embodied ethical drama you're in. The question is recognizing when that tension can be resolved conceptually and when you are in a state of embodied consciousness, embodied cognition, and you understand that dynamic of embodied cognition is participating in the drama of your personally or collectively working through that tension. And it may at some point take a conceptual form, because it's not only you engaging in this, but there's all kinds of shifts that are taking place in culture outside of yourself. Now, I said I was going to go to a different place, and that's the global workspace theory. And the global workspace theory has you, in effect, you're this being who's trying to make sense of this world, and something comes into consciousness, and you have to act upon it, and it's broadcast, and resources are rallied. Well, obviously, different kinds of challenges have different kinds of counters on them. I mean, sometimes you have to act now. Who was talking about? It wasn't Steve, it was somebody else. Excuse me. I was thinking it was you, but this issue with the Polish priests who made untenable decisions during the Second World War, and whether we're going to crucify them forever for being human beings in situations which were untenable. Well, I mean, we can be ethical to the extent that we have the intensity and the capacity to, you know, to function within that, but few of us are heroic, and sometimes the timer or the pressures on us force us to take actions that will leave us with wounds or divisions that we'll spend the rest of our life trying to ameliorate.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand. But I want to ask a question that I hope will clarify. It seemed to me that at times you were talking specifically, fairly specifically, about the distinction between being, let's say, a third-person scientist and a first-person human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then at other times it seems as though you were talking about a broader issue about how does one deal with being in ethical tension, and several of the questions that were coming from over here were taking that broader perspective. But,
right.
but I understood you would be talking more about first division, and just in terms of, I suppose, my interest, but partly what's going on here at the conference, that strikes me as a very fruitful avenue to explore. I'm not so sure about the larger ethical issue and where that takes us exactly, because we wind up talking about Polish priests in World War II, which is an important question.
Mm-hmm.
I
tried to do that in the first slide and just show how for me this evolved in this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, there was a point that was probably more this waxing back and forth between the scientist and the transformator.
Right.
And I'm still in that. I mean, the days when I can be the scientist and the days when I can meditate and, you know, there's no self-evident tension impinging upon me. But I think the broader question is who we are as embodied beings, and that oftentimes what we embody are these tensions of the various internal and external pressures upon us. And it's a question of which of those can we resolve conceptually, scientifically, if you like, and which require an engagement which will be both a not knowing and a self-transformatory dynamic between us and whatever those forces are. The place of contention.
So if I can just continue with that, I think maybe I'm starting to see the connection, because it hasn't been clear to me. But so there are certain kinds of questions for which you can say, okay, let's take a third person view. Mm-hmm. And then there are certain kinds of questions for which you can say, let's take a first person view. And in part, there's going to be a question about where, you know, what falls where. And ethical decisions, if I understand you, really, well, okay, there's room for argument, but one possible stand would be to say, ultimately, ethical questions really are going to be resolved from standing in that kind of tension, dwelling within that tension, which is going to be a first-person perspective.
You're going to be in it from a first-person point of view, but the tension, and this is probably the part that I had set up this talk for, but maybe never actually expressed, which was the question of how embodied is cognition. So the point is, if cognition is an expression of a relationship, then we're getting into sort of something that's not quite first person and not quite third person. Is it second person? I don't know. I mean, I find this language starts to just go berserk for me, because I don't know if I'm a third person scientist or if I'm a first person meditator or, you know, or yogi or whatever, you know. There's a point at which consciousness seems to be consciousness of the relationship. And the consciousness is formed by whatever relational dynamics your body is in relationship to.
You don't have to be either one or the other, do you? If you could be the neck of you, kind of guy.
Come back to this, John's question, your remarks about embodiedness. if you have lesions of prefrontal cortex, you are unlikely to be a moral agent, and you don't make moral decisions. It seems that what that has done is taken away access to your somatic markers, which would have helped you make the moral decisions. So, interestingly enough, it looks as though those are operating actually because and the moral, so the somatic markers operate almost pre-reflectively. I mean, Mark Hauser's work suggests that people make these moral decisions immediately, and only with difficulty at a conscious level can justify them afterwards. But they've been made by their body in a way before they begun to issue conscious
levels. And even something that you've resolved after the fact conceptually, you may now have, in an Aristotelian sense, automatized it.
Mm-hmm.
And you now act it out, not necessarily consciously. There may be a moment of conscious mediation, but more or less your affective heuristics are determining your response to that challenge. I mean, so the role of conceptualization or deliberation or even metacognition may actually be more confined to, you know, to special cases.
Yeah.
Than we want to acknowledge, because it really is our affective heuristics that are framing who we are, where we stand, how we respond. And in fact, the biggest issue I think has become the fact that our affective heuristics seem to have certain things in them that we wouldn't consider moral. So Mazarin Banerjee, Greenberg studies, I mean, all their work on implicit values seems to reveal that even the most liberal of us are racist. Now, I mean, that's a simplistic way of putting it, but, you know, people who have been unbelievably liberal and sensitive their whole life are taken aback when they take these tests to find out that they seem to have these implicit racist responses, but when confronting Mazarin on the, the pessimism in this view of human nature, she responds and says, no, the wonderful thing is that we can manage that. We are becoming, we are conscious of it. So the implicit, the negative or prejudicial heuristics aren't going away. But we are learning, we are creating other counter mechanisms or deliberative mechanisms that allow us to defuse or override those in situations where they're inappropriate.
Wendell, there's something that kind of keeps troubling me during this conversation, and it's not a matter of disagreement with what you're saying at all, because as a matter of fact, I've eloquently laid out my position on this, so it's obviously excellent work. But the thing that troubles me is that here is this conversation and this frame of reference within which we address these, and then out there is society. And society, I'm afraid, does not live comfortably with the tension. I think the messages you get growing up damn near anywhere in the world is that if there's an issue, you have to take sides on. And that if you don't, you're being wishy-washy or flip-flopping, or that it is morally and socially and politically undesirable to put yourself in that position.
So this touches on, I would say for me, what is the existential question of my life, which is, are those of us engaged in that just engaged in a holding action in a world that, you know, without that, without some of us engaged in a holding action with governments like the strike zone, or is the role we can play in socially working through the tension embodied some kind of progress? And the difficulty is there's no way to know or look at that in a coherent sense. If I look at slavery as a moral issue, I would say yes, there has been progress in the last 150 years in human intelligence. But I can look at other dimensions that make me very dubious. So I would say, in the end, for me, this is the great unanswerable question. It is the question I want to invoke in my embodied life, which is, are we going anywhere? Is this just a holding action? And I can't say that anything has revealed itself in my holding that tension in a way where I have any idea.
I think that's a good place to stop. 6 o'clock, it's a wonderful summing up. Thank you.
Wendell, as you were talking, for some reason I thought of something that Robert Benchley wrote. Remember Robert Benchley?
Vaguely. Yeah.
He said there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who think there are two kinds of people in the world.
Yeah.